This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to our new series, Elements of State Health Reform, a partnership with the National Governors Association. These interactive web shows will look at the growing momentum for health reform in the states and probe the key issues policymakers are facing as they develop approaches to cover the uninsured and make healthcare more affordable. Many reform plans seek to expand the role of private, non-group insurance, and in the case of legislation being implemented in Massachusetts and proposed by Governor Schwarzenegger in California, individuals will be required to buy insurance. Yet in most cases today, the non-group insurance market is not accessible to everyone, potentially excluding people with pre-existing medical conditions or subjecting them to surcharges. And it's not a market that allows for easy comparisons of benefits and premiums. Today, we look at what can be done to make individual private insurance available and affordable through insurance market regulation and purchasing pools, like the new connector in Massachusetts. We're joined by a panel of state and national experts who have both studied these issues and worked to implement practical approaches to reform. Karen Politz previously worked on the Hill and for HHS. Today, as a researcher at Georgetown University, she runs healthinsuranceinfo.net, a terrific source of information about state insurance rules. Ed Hasselmeyer is a health policy expert at the Heritage Foundation, who is often called upon to help policymakers develop health reform plans. And John Kingsdale is the founding head of the new Massachusetts Health Insurance Connector, following a distinguished career in the insurance industry. You can reach our panel of experts by emailing your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Karen Politz, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the non-group insurance market today. What types of holes are there in that market?
Well, I have to say, as an academic, it's the most fun to study things that are quirky and dysfunctional, so I have a lot of fun studying the individual health insurance market. I guess before I talk about what's wrong with it, I should talk about how you know when insurance is working well. And to begin with, it's important to remember, seems obvious, but worth restating, we buy health insurance in case we get sick, not in case we stay healthy. And for insurance to work for you when you're sick, it has to meet what I call the triple A test. So the insurance has to be available to you, it has to be affordable, and it has to be adequate to guarantee you the access to the healthcare that you need without leaving you with ruinous unpaid medical bills. And the individual health insurance market almost never gets straight A's. Never even gets one A a lot of the time. So,
give us some examples of how.
Okay, so there's a lot of things that happen in the individual market, and I should also mention that it is a different market state to state, so some of this depends on where you live. But in most states, to begin with, the individual health insurance market is medically underwritten, and that means it's not available to you if you have a serious health condition. So if you have diabetes or cancer or heart disease, or if you're pregnant, you'll be turned down every time in a medically underwritten market. And if you have even a mild health condition like acne or hay fever, you might be turned down for that as well. So the individual market is pretty fussy about who they will sell health insurance to. If you can buy health insurance, you also then need to know that the premium will depend on a lot of things. So there's not a single price for an insurance policy. It'll cost you more if you're sick. It'll cost you more if you're older. It may cost you more depending on the occupation you work in and other factors, based on your gender, too. That can affect your insurance premium. And then in terms of adequacy, the individual market tries desperately to do better on the affordability thing, to bring the price down. But their main trick for doing that is to limit what individual policies cover. So if you go out shopping, you may actually find lots of health insurance policies for sale in the individual market that are $30 or $50 a month, but they don't cover very much. They don't cover maternity care. They may not cover prescription drugs. They may have very high deductibles, $5,000 or $10,000 per year. So for all of those reasons, it can be a really, really tough market to operate in.
And is fixing this market from your perspective as simple as telling insurers they have to take anyone, prohibiting medical underwriting, and saying they have to charge a community rate, the same rate to everyone?
Well, that's a beginning. You definitely need to do those things. You can't fix the market and make it work, again, for people who are sick unless you do those things. But in addition, you would need to throw in some pretty good subsidies, because this is a market that, even when it's working well, is inherently expensive. It doesn't have the economies of scale of a group policy, so there's a lot of load. You know, more of your premium dollar goes to pay to administer the policy than to pay your claims. And it's not subsidized by definition. Your employer's not helping you pay the premium the way they would for group coverage. And the tax benefits that would apply to employer-based coverage generally don't apply in this market. So you need to subsidize people pretty heavily if you're going to expect them to go into this market, because most people won't be able to afford it.
And Ed Hasmart, I mean, would you share Karen's assessment of the way the market works today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, because it's a holdover from basically a very different design in a very different era when health insurance and health care was very different. You know, it's left over from a world in which health insurance was run like auto insurance on the premise that we didn't know why people got sick or when they'd get sick, and when they did, there wasn't a lot you could do for them. So, you know, it was cheap, it was affordable, and today that's no longer true. And so the system is dysfunctional. The problem is that there is an inherent advantage to having the individual own the plan, because then you align the incentives in the system so that the providers, the plan, et cetera, works for the individual. I mean, the problem we have with healthcare in general is that the people who are paying for it, which is you and me, I mean, ultimately, one way or another, I don't care how you organize your system, we pay for it. I mean, all that money the employer supposedly pays is really our compensation. You know, all that government money, the government programs, that's all our tax dollars, you know. So, and ultimately, we're the ones who are getting the care. It's not the government or the corporation going to the doctor. But we're left out of the decision.
So you think it makes sense to move this market from employers providing most of the coverage to individuals?
Well, I think if you're going to get a system that aligns incentives, that says, look, how do we, because we know that a lot of healthcare services that are delivered are either unnecessary or in some cases downright harmful. I mean, I was just, you know, at an NCSL conference where they had folks from Intermountain Health, University of Utah, Professor James, and, you know, he's saying like half of this stuff is, you know, pointless if not dangerous, and that's just appalling record. I mean, not even our most incompetent industries do that bad. But the only way you're going to get there, you can't sort of regulate your way to a better health system. What you have to do is you have to get everybody working in the direction of saying, look, I'm going to get rewarded for doing better and costing less, okay? But to get that, you have to have the person, you know, you have to ultimately have the consumer in control of it. So the problem, the conundrum you have is you have a very dysfunctional individual market, but for reasons of policy, you want to move in the direction of consumer ownership and control. So what you have to do is you have to look at how do you fix the market.
And do you, I mean, to get to that consumer control, are the regulations you think you need in the individual insurance market to make it accessible?
Oh, sure. I mean, here's another point. We have a system that, again, that you look and you say, what's the underlying premise here? This is a system that's premised on the idea, and this is true of the employer group market as well as the individual, that the seller is going to go out and find customers. Okay, the seller picks the customer. Now, that's very different from a market in which you say, well, we're going to line up all the sellers and bring the customers in, and the customers get to pick what they want. Okay, so in a world in which the seller picks the customer, and again, this is true of the group market, it's just more pronounced in the individual market, there's some customers you don't want to sell to, right?
It's sick people.
Yeah, sick people or whatever. But there are also some customers who you might not be avoiding, but they're a lot of bother to go after. So, I mean, it's a lot easier to sell to the ones that are right in front of you, that you just walk across the street, as opposed to trying to make the sale, you know, half a continent away. Well, and the same thing in healthcare. It's a lot easier to sell to that employer with 100 employees, and you say, well, wow, I get that lined up, and boom, it's all done, as opposed to the pizza joint with 5 employees. And then when you get to the level, I mean, you can be the healthiest person in the world, but if you have one part-time job at Home Depot and another one at Wendy's, I mean, that's just a nightmare to try to make that work in the market that we have today. So you have to change that market dynamic.
So is that where the idea of a connector?
Yeah, that's a lot of what's behind that, is to say, look, this is about reorganizing the way it is delivered. And that's where it differs from some of the, it has elements of pooling. But that's where it differs from some of the pooling arrangements. The pooling arrangements that you had in like the California HIPIC, these health small business pools, were based, and I know you have Rick Curtis talking about some of this, were based largely on a variant of the existing model, which is, well, okay, if we get 1,000 employers of 10 employees each, then we'll have a group of 10,000 and we'll go see if we can get somebody to cover them as a group. But again, the individual employee doesn't have a lot to say on the subject. Okay. That's kind of like the grocery buyer. You know, somebody who goes out and looks at the farmer's produce and says, well, I'll buy your tomatoes from your field and put them in my supermarket. Okay, and then when you and I go in there, that's what we get. As opposed to the sort of stock market or farmer's market kind of approach where, again, you line up all the sellers and the buyers come in and they pick what they want. Well, and that's the difference.
Let me bring John Kingsdale into this. And John's joining us on the phone from Boston. And I was trying to make some of this work on the ground in Massachusetts. John, first start by telling us a little bit about, you took over the Connector, founded the Connector. Tell us, just give us a quick summary of what your responsibilities are. What is the Connector trying to accomplish?
Okay, I think I need to back up and give you some principles of our health reform here. So one is subsidized coverage for low-income uninsured, and there's federal and state tax dollars to do that. The second one is, under the rubric of shared responsibility, have employers do whatever they can to make sure they're offering insurance and they're offering on a pre-tax payroll deduction basis, and that they're offering something, not only they, but in the non-group market, that meets one of Karen's, I guess, her third A, adequate coverage, so that at a minimum, that coverage gives people some access to preventive care and the kind of health security that you have with some caps on your exposure. So if, God forbid, you have catastrophic costs, your coverage protects you from medical bankruptcy. So those are all key elements. And then the last one is the requirement that we're doing regs on just now to have everybody who can possibly afford it have to have health insurance. So government's stepping to the line, employers are stepping to the line, and individuals are stepping to the line too to get that last 5% of our uninsured insured. There's a lot of responsibilities involved in doing that. The Connector has a major piece, but not all of it. The two primary pieces that we have are to develop a subsidized health insurance program for the low-income uninsured, which we call Commonwealth Care. And we launched that in November 1st was the first enrollees. We are now, as of April 1, we'll have over 60,000 newly insured people, folks who didn't have insurance and didn't have a routine source of care, et cetera, for years, in some cases decades, will have insurance. And that's almost 50% of our target market for the Commonwealth Care program. The second major program is we call Commonwealth Choice, and I would underscore choice go back to both Ed and Karen's points about the non-group market not having a lot of choice. And that is private insurance. We're basically organizing an exchange or a market for private insurance in which if we can lure the customer to the shopping mall, and in health insurance that's a whole lot more difficult than some of the analogies that Ed used, and we can talk some more about that, but this is very much a push sale typically. But if we can get them to shop, they'll see 7 different health plans at different levels of benefits offered, be able to compare premiums, cost sharing, provider network, and hopefully make a very rational and informed choice of health plan that meets that minimum health security standard. So those are the two main programs, and then we have a whole bunch of other regulatory things that we have to do, but that's the essence.
And John, tell us what's been your biggest challenge so far in making this work? or pick one. Pick one.
That's a tough one. I am fond of saying I have a list of 137 major anxieties about this. Let me put it this way, by way of context, Larry. It took 3 years, literally, to hammer out the compromise and to sign legislation that, unlike almost any other major health insurance reform that I'm aware of, was not energized by stigmatizing and rousing emotional anger at one, two, or three parties. Nobody picked out the insurance industry or hospitals or government. They actually were all in the tent, and it took 3 years to do that, which isn't surprising when you think that we're reforming 16% of our gross domestic product or our state domestic product. And so the biggest challenge now is to keep that broad political support while we grapple with some of the major, major controversial decisions that, frankly, the legislature couldn't resolve and buck to us, and to do it in a way that is on track, doesn't give the dozens and dozens and dozens of critics who would love a chance to declare this a failure an opportunity to do so. So keep everybody in the boat and move that boat forward with our eyes very much on the point of the shore we want to hit, which is 99% coverage of the Massachusetts citizens.
You asked me, you talked about your anxieties, and you had a bit of a bump in the road recently as you were working to define the level of coverage and premium that would be affordable for people who would be required to buy insurance. Obviously a difficult task. And you were, I think, by many reports, quite successful in the end in getting the premium down from some of the initial bids from carriers. Talk a little bit about how you accomplished that. I think many people would be interested to know how that's done.
Okay, I'd be happy to. And I'm glad you brought it up, Larry, because the number you're referring to is $380. That was a slip of somebody's tongue at a board meeting that got picked up by a reporter who then put it on the front page of the paper of record. It was then picked up by every would-be critic in the country and trumpeted as clear evidence that healthcare reform had failed. And the truth is we didn't get the number down from 380 to 175. Those are two very different numbers. The 380 was, as I say, somebody's quick calculation at a board meeting. We have three-hour board meetings. They're really press conferences. And basically it was like having an incumbent office holder. We had to do a campaign to replace a false number that was virtually nationally accepted with a real number. So I can't even explain to you what the 380 was. What we did was we went back to the carriers who had bid, and we said, sharpen your pencils, and let's have some exchange of information. What are you assuming when you put in your bid about the acuity of this population? What are you assuming about our ability to deliver a broad cross-section of risk to you versus your worst nightmare, as it so happens, it so often happens in the individual market that you'll just get, you know, relatively sick people. And we had that exchange of information. We went back and forth. Some of those carriers lowered their bids significantly, but not from 380 to 175. I don't want to mislead anybody. But beyond that, we didn't pick all the carriers that bid. Guess what? We picked the lower bidders. You know, big surprise. Not everybody has to pay the highest or the average price that in the end the seven carriers we picked were bidding. What they have to do is buy a plan that meets certain standards. So we very appropriately focused on what is the lowest cost plan available to you in your area for the average uninsured individual who's a 37-year-old male in Massachusetts. What would be the price you would have to pay to get coverage? And that's the 175. So it's a combination of exchange of information and negotiation, sharpening pencils, selecting from among the carriers that bid the seven we wanted, and then recognizing that if you want, and our market research says 94% of these buyers will buy on price, they're probably going to buy a lower price plan among a spread of options.
Well, we're ready to anoint you a miracle worker, but it sounds like maybe you just ask some good questions of the folks in the market.
There are no miracles in health insurance.
I want to move on to, we have a lot of questions that have come in by email and want to move on to a few of those. Let me start with this one from Georgia. This questioner writes, that Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Hampshire recently announced a new product it is making available there called Tonic. It is designed for younger policyholders and has a monthly premium of $130 for a 19-year-old. This compares very favorably with the recent public information available on the second round connector plan bids, with the only plan available under $200 having only 14 physicians in Greater Boston. The plan has a lower deductible, $1,500 versus $2,000. Wouldn't this lead one to believe that the power of the open market to control costs is greater than the government through plans like the connector? And Karen, let me start with you. Plan Tonic, I think, is available not just in New Hampshire, but elsewhere as well. And how do you think about when you're comparing a plan like Tonic and these market rates and what those might mean in a system where you have universal coverage and everyone's in the market?
Well, it's a great question because health insurance is a word that means a bunch of different things. In Massachusetts, it's going to be the case that when you say health insurance, you know what it means because the state has required this is what health insurance has to cover. In most states, that's not the case. So comparing Tonic to what will be sold in Massachusetts or what you would get at work is kind of like comparing a roller skate to a car. The roller skate's cheaper, but I wouldn't want to drive it to Chicago. I just wouldn't. So, and I haven't looked at the policy that they're selling in New Hampshire. I have looked at the Tonic policy that's sold in other states. And the one that I've looked at covers, I believe, 4 doctor visits a year. That's it. Doesn't cover maternity, doesn't cover mental health, doesn't cover rehab, doesn't cover prescription drugs. So there's a bunch of stuff that isn't covered. And that's all fine if you're marketing at a young and healthy customer base, which is what Tonic is trying to sell to. But if you come down with cancer, you're going to go broke if you have that policy. So you're going to pay out of pocket for most of your cancer care, plus you will have paid the $100 a month in the premium. So you will have paid a premium for the price of still going medically bankrupt. So that's the difference.
Ned Hausmann, let me, do you, in your vision, is this, you know, what level of standardization should...
I think this is a difficult area because the temptation is to over-standardize, and you really want to avoid that because it's important to have innovation in plan design as well as innovation in the medical care. I think we have a certain amount of standardization there already. I mean, what we're really talking about is major medical insurance. Okay, now, yes, Karen's right, different states will define that differently. But we do have some reference points for that in statute. You know, part of it is defining what is not major medical. That, you know, certain things like, you know, the medical liability on your auto insurance or so, or limited disease or hospital only or things like that, that's not clearly what we're talking about. So in a state drafting this sort of thing, you can exclude a lot of that. You can really focus it. I think a good standard is what we have in federal law for what constitutes credible coverage under HIPAA, you know. Basically, so it's not hard to work with these standards. You might adjust them somewhat. Yeah, clearly you want you don't want people to face catastrophic expenses, etc. You just have to be sure that you don't over-standardize it to the point where you lose the benefits of flexibility. Because the thing to remember is different people have different preferences. And John was talking about how some of the target, 96% of them are going to be buying on price, and that's probably true. For the first year or two, okay? But then as people go on in the system, what we find is the price is only one consideration. There are other considerations in there, the benefits, the form of the policy. I mean, I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to things like an HMO or a PPO or an HSA because different people have different risk tolerances. If you're the kind of person who, when you go to buy a refrigerator or an appliance and they offer you the extended warranty, if you take the extended warranty, you probably want an HMO, If you tend to not take the extended warranty, you may be more likely to buy an HSA. I mean, these are people's personal preferences. The nice thing about a consumer-driven market is you move away from a system where it's just cost, cost, and cost as the decision element, and more of these things come into play. And we see that in, federal employee benefits program and things like that. The other point, just very briefly, is, and this is very important for other states looking at this, is I'm constantly telling states, you're not doing Massachusetts. You may do your variation of the same basic approach, but you have to remember that a lot of what Massachusetts did is very specific to Massachusetts. And each state has its own problems and its own strengths and weaknesses. So, for example, when you're comparing premiums, you have to recognize that one of the big problems they confronted in Massachusetts, I think John would agree with this, is they've got among the highest underlying cost of care in the country. So, I mean, that's just the docs and hospitals. So that's a very different issue. The hospital system is much less competitive than, say, in the Northwest, in Washington or California. Those are just issues you have to deal with. So it's a little difficult to compare on a premium basis from state to state.
And John Kingston, let me ask you, aside from the question of the costs in Massachusetts, which you may or may not want to talk about, would a plan like Tonic, to the extent you're familiar with it, be something that people could buy in Massachusetts, or would the requirements you're setting out prohibit a plan like that?
Well, I'd like to make a couple of comments on it. So let me take your question first, but there's some additional assumptions in the questioner's question that I want to address. Tonic, as I understand it, not only has limitations, but, and I don't know the New Hampshire underwriting rules, but in California, the primary reason that it's inexpensive, and it can be half of that $130 in California, is that it's medically underwritten. And I have friends in their 20s who have had allergies, you know, mild allergies. They can't get Tonic. So you really need to look at value and availability when you want to compare price. Now,
and is that, John, yeah, I'm just sorry to stop you, but just to clarify, and I don't think we set this out in the beginning. I mean, in Massachusetts, in addition to creating the connector, there are also insurance market rules that, that would prohibit medical underwriting.
Right, absolutely. And by the way, I agree with that about choice. I'm not saying Tonic is a bad policy. Tonic is fine. It's nice, cheap insurance that gives some level of coverage if you happen to be pretty healthy. So it's fine for healthy people. It is not a solution to get most people health security. And that's what we're trying to do in Massachusetts. So it's a solution to a need that some folks in the market have, not a solution to the policy issue we're trying to deal with here. But the other issue that's very, very important, and that questioner really is off the mark here, and I want to speak directly to it, is this is a market solution. We are setting up a market, a shopping mall for insurance. Even the subsidized program creates competition between the plans to bid for access to our population, and then additional competition, organized market with 28 different choices of plans. Some people think it's too confusing, too much choice of plans. Who we're going to standardize them to the extent that you don't have to read a 100-page EOC to find out that one plan covers 20 PT visits and another plan covers 23 physical therapy visits, because who cares about that? We're going to take some of that stuff out and allow consumers to focus on the six primary variables: price, cost sharing, network, drug formulary, which hospitals are in, those kind of important, critical shopping variables, because nobody is going to read. It's like if you went shopping for a car and you had to read a 100-page manual on the engine in order to figure out whether it runs, that's not a shopping experience. You know, that's a legal exam. So this, I really want to be clear, this is very much market-organized and competitive-driven choice. Focused reform.
John, let me stay with you for a second on that issue. We got a lot of emails about why not expand Medicare to cover everyone? Why not embrace a universal single payer system? That was an email from Washington State. Mm-hmm. I just want to get all your views on this issue, and I'll read one other email. And the emailer writes, excessive overhead related to the complexity of provider billing and collections and the insurance overhead and profit. Despite highly competitive insurance markets in the U.S. and highest out-of-pocket costs among OECD countries, we have not achieved better cost control, better quality of care, or affordability of insurance. What evidence is there that the connector as a regulated market will change the situation? What value does a myriad of insurers bring to the consumer? And John, I just want to stay with you to speak to that. I mean, what... sort of stepping back a little bit, and the idea, I mean, you talked about this being market-driven. What in your view is the value of that kind of market-driven system over, let's say, Medicare or a single-payer system?
Well, first of all, I want to deny that I'm, despite that strong statement about how this reform works, that I would object to a single-payer. I mean, I think, you know, Ed's probably shuddering, but there's a lot to recommend a single-payer system. There's a lot of problems with a single-payer system, just like there's a lot to recommend a competitive market-driven system, and there are problems with it. Anybody who thinks one is their nirvana, I think, is just being a little bit naive. So certainly one of the advantages of centralized manufacturing in the Soviet Union or a single universal health plan is it's a lot more efficient, it's a lot clearer. You don't have the marketing costs. You don't have to regulate the market and the nature of the competition. Lots of advantages to it. There are real problems with it as well. And I don't think you want me to go into all those, but I'd be happy to if you want to.
Oh, we've got several hours, don't you?
Yeah, right. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm dealing with what is, and I want to move from what is to something really much better. And we've been waiting for 70 years for national health insurance. We in Massachusetts are tired of waiting for national health insurance. We want to get almost everybody, if not everybody, here insured. I mean, there are 60,000 people in Massachusetts since November 1st who are newly insured. They have doctors. They have awful chronic diseases that they didn't know they had for the last 3 years because they haven't had a primary care visit. I want to move from 5% uninsured to less than 1% uninsured, and if I have to wait for a national health insurance plan to do it, I'll be dead before it happens. So, and so will the, you know, anyway. So it's very important, I think, to recognize that improving significantly what we have is a real significant event. And the market is, you know, we had bids for our subsidized health plans. We took 15% out of those bids through competition. Now we have people who are eligible, 60,000, they're picking among those plans. They have to think very carefully if they want to pick anything but the lower price of the four plans because they have to pay the incremental premium for it. Some of them do, and that's their choice, and that's great. By the way, there's a whole lot more than 14 doctors in that low-price plan in Boston. That's totally wrong. I don't know where that came from. We've got seven options now on the table for the private insurance place. Plans in our Commonwealth Choice shopping mall. Folks are going to pick on price as well as on network, and they are going to drive those health plans to bid even more aggressively next year to stay on the shelf. And I think there's a lot of value in that because when you look at the alternatives in a highly politicized democracy such as ours, you depend on a single government agency to make wise choices and to cut costs for all of us. That's a tough challenge to lay before a bureaucracy, and it's not without its pitfalls. I actually find the market works better in that respect.
Ed, let me ask you, what would you say to a critic who says, isn't a market system with multiple insurers just inefficient, that there's a more efficient way of doing this?
I mean, the answer is, first off, the question of whether it really is inefficient. If it's structured the right way, it doesn't necessarily have to be. I think the point is you can structure a single-payer system in a number of different ways. I mean, the Canadian system, the British system, they're very different, just like the VA and the Medicare system in this country are very different. Similarly, you can structure a market different ways. I think it's a measure of how dysfunctional our market is that people would consider a single government alternative as somehow superior. I mean, as bad as Detroit is with, you know, cars, I mean, I've yet to hear anybody say, well, we just ought to do away with them and nationalize and have one, you know, U.S. auto company to make cars. But people do say that in healthcare. What happens with these systems is that they operate according to incentives and rules. And that's true whether it's a government-run system or a market system. So the question you have to ask is, are the rules and the incentives going to get you where you want to go? In other words, is the insurance company going to make money by investing in preventive care and keeping you healthy and keeping you out of the hospital, or are they going to make money by avoiding treating you? Okay, what do they do? Because in too much of the system today, and this is true in a national health system, you know, the easiest way to save money is don't treat people. And the second easiest way is if you have to treat them, don't pay the provider. I mean, you know, we run these programs in this country. We call it Medicaid, you know, and I talk to state lawmakers and I say, you know, I've got data that shows that the Medicaid population uses the emergency room at twice the rate of the uninsured and five times the rate of the private insured. And why? Well, in large measure, because you pay providers so little, there's nobody else for them to go to. Now, have you really saved anything? Have you, you know, what is your incentive here? Are you really getting where you want to go? That's the whole point. You know, I have a fellow who worked for, I think it was Price Waterhouse, one of those consulting firms. He did healthcare, and he was in Britain, you know, and he was sitting with, you know, people running a National Health Service hospital and showing them how they could improve patient throughput, how you could, you know, get more people in, treat them, get them out quicker, right? And then he suddenly, about halfway through, stopped and said, And the guy said, you know, but why would I want that? I live under a global budget. That just uses up my budget. So the incentive is not to treat people. So it doesn't matter whether it's a market or the data is pretty clear. I mean, the data, you know, like Brent James from University of Utah was saying, you know, this is the same in systems with single payer. They're wasting half their money too on things that, you know, don't work or are downright harmful.
But the question is
how do you get the right incentive? So that's what you're looking at in this. I mean, one of the interesting things is we do see in consumer choice markets, we see some things that do tend to work in that direction. So for example, in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, which is sort of a model for this and runs the same way. It's a large employer plan, but people get to pick once a year, and the government really doesn't standardize the benefits. It just has, you know, real insurance plans come in there and, you know, the same companies that you know, and offer benefits. Well, not only does it control costs, but what we find is that only 11% of people switch every year. It's not the same 11%. What happens is people will switch, and then they'll find a plan that they like, and then they stay with it. So when you're talking about things like the incentives for a plan to invest up front in preventive care, well, why do that if the employer is going to, you know, replace you with somebody else next year and the employees don't have any say in it?
And employees are moving from job to job
right,
as well.
Right. And so, yeah, you have that. So you actually tend to have people stay with a plan much longer in a system where they get to choose what they want. Now, that's good. That's aligning the incentives to say, look, this plan is working for the benefit of that subscriber. And the other thing I say to doctors and hospitals, as well as to the insurers, I said, right now you have this business where you sort of, you know, club each other. I mean, the insurers say, well, I'm going to get 100,000 people, and you're going to just have to take my rate, or I'll cut them out of, you know, cut you out of my network. And these people are like sheep. They can't go to that doctor or that hospital. Well, if you're in a situation where they can say, like they will be able to in Massachusetts, well, wait a minute, if you do that, I really like that doctor or hospital, I think I'll switch to a different insurer, then the insurers and the doctors and hospitals have to get a lot more reasonable, because on the doctor and hospital side, the insurer can say, well, yeah, you can go there, but it's going to cost you extra because, you know, they charge more and their data isn't, you know, they're not delivering demonstrably any better than somebody else. So, you know, I think all of that works to the benefit of the consumer.
Karen, let me ask you, as Ed talks about aligning the incentives, what in your view is the you know, it's a hard thing to disagree with, I think, but what in your view is the right way to do that in a reform system?
Well, I guess either way, there needs to be a wise and considered role for government, whether we're going to just have government-provided health care or whether we're going to have a market. In the other markets that Ed has drawn an analogy to, whether you're buying tomatoes or cars, I mean, we have lemon laws. We don't give people the choice of buying a car that doesn't run, and we penalize someone that tries to do that, or a tomato that will poison you if you put it in your sauce. So we need to make sure that the market is sort of operating within permissible bounds if we're going to have it that way, or that the government program is working that way. We also have to remember, this is not like these other products. When you buy a tomato, you bring it home, it's a tomato, you eat it that day, it's done. All right? Health insurance you buy today in case next week or next month or next year you get hit by a car or you find a lump in the shower. So you're buying something today to protect you from something in the future, and you don't know what it is. And you don't know how much protection you will need. So I might feel okay if I'm feeling really good today about buying a policy that doesn't have prescription drugs, because I'm not taking any prescription drugs, so I feel pretty good about that. And I used to feel pretty good about that before I got cancer. And I had no idea what prescription drugs cost until I got cancer. They are expensive, and you really need them. You can't get through treatment without them. And I didn't know that as a 35-year-old woman. I really had no concept of that until it hit me. And I don't think we want this kind of buyer beware, you know, oh, well, you picked the cheap plan with the crummy drug policy and the limited formulary, and now you'll just have to, like, die in chemotherapy because you can't get through it. So I think we want some of those. If the primary purpose of health insurance is to pay your bills, then we want to make sure that whatever your choices are, they're going to pay your bills. These other things that we want to achieve from our healthcare system are absolutely important. We want more efficiency in healthcare. We want better quality. We want people to get to doctors who will really take good care of them and treat them like people. And we need all of those things. It's not at all clear to me that we can achieve all of that using just the tool of health insurance and how we design policies and who gets it. That's just the beginning. So I think we need to take a broader look and make sure that health insurance does what it's supposed to do, which is pay your bills when you get sick, and then continue to address these other incredibly important issues through the way we train doctors, through public health, through prevention, through better nutrition, all kinds of things that we are going to need to do, better research, better outcomes measures. That needs to get brought into bear regardless of what our system is. That's important for Medicare. That's important for people in the private market.
And Ed, it's set a minimum standard, so
I don't disagree with any of that. And the thing that's, I think, very good about the states doing this, and the more I travel around and work with the states, is there is a huge difference, not just in geography, but in the demographics. There's some states I'm working with that are very rural. They have issues. Massachusetts did. I mentioned how Massachusetts has certain issues that those states didn't have. There's demographics, how your system is organized, how the money flows, the politics, all of this. And so this does give the opportunity for states to do different variants. I mean, my rule of thumb is, yes, the government's there to set the rules. That is the proper function of government. As in any area, you just want them to do the least necessary. I mean, don't over-engineer the rules. Always try to make sure that you've covered all the possibilities, but do it in as predictable and streamlined a fashion as you can. So, for example, the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, I mean, they only require coverage of basic categories of benefits. They don't spell out in great detail. Everybody has quality insurance in there. All the products cover catastrophic. They all cover drugs, et cetera. Yeah, I would say that you have to cover, docs, hospitals, inpatient, outpatient, drugs, mental health, and you can't do anything egregious like exclude a particular disease or something like that, or have an unreasonably, or have caps or things like that. Beyond that, I'm not sure how much specificity you need. Now, different states will do it differently. And there are trade-offs, and that's the point that I make to states. I mean, one of the points I made about Massachusetts is Massachusetts already came at this with fairly comprehensive standardization of benefits, with guaranteed issue and fairly tight community rating. Now, for whatever reasons relating to Massachusetts, they weren't going to move away from that too much. Well, that's fine, but there's a trade-off, and the trade-off is that the issue of a consumer market where people pick between plan A and plan B and plan C and D, and then the plans are worried that they might somehow disproportionately get sick people, that's less of an issue in that kind of market because there's more standardization. So you don't really have to deal with some of the risk adjustment as much, and they didn't in Massachusetts.
Ed, let me,
the flip side is you really have to make the young, healthy people buy it because they've overpriced the product just because of the rating rules. So, if a state does it with a different variation in rating, they're going to have to maybe have less forcing people in and maybe more trying to adjust for risk.
Let me pick up on that issue of states and recognize that we are co-sponsoring this with the National Governors Association Center for Best Practices. We got a number of emails about the role of states versus the federal government, and one in particular was how can truly comprehensive health reform be accomplished at the state level without waivers from the federal government? And that was from Washington State. Let me turn to John for a moment. John, this was a state-based reform, but you didn't do it without the federal government. What kind of help did you need from the feds to make this work?
Well, we needed financial and political help. Finances, I think, have been well reported that our Medicaid waiver, which covers a multitude of programs, and specifically close to $400 million a year in federal subsidies for our free care safety net program, was in jeopardy, and we were going to have it taken away, as some states, including California, already have, if we didn't reform the way we were providing kind of a security net for the uninsured. And this reform is very much focused on trying to move people who are income eligible and uninsured from sort of massive block grants to safety net hospitals to give them episodic care into an insurance model where individuals pick a plan, pick a primary care physician, and the money follows them and their choice rather than large multi-million dollar grants, in effect, to large institutions to take care of the folks who happen to show up in their emergency room or for hospitalization. So that was one way. But it's important to realize, I think, and I stress this whenever I talk to folks from other states, it took 3 years for us to work this out, and I am convinced we would not have worked it out other than but for the embarrassment and the financial loss of not coming up with a plan that would keep that $385 million a year coming to the state from Washington, D.C. I can't emphasize enough how important the politics of not letting people just retreat to their second favorite plan, which is the status quo, was in our passing this. So federal role is critical, and it continues to be, because we operate under a waiver from CMS that has to be renewed.
And do you feel confident you can, I'm guessing the answer is yes, but do you feel confident you can sustain this at the state level, even if other states don't move ahead?
Yes, I do. Will there be some 21-year-old graduating from college who decides to heck with this universal obligation here, and I'm weighing two job offers, I'm going to go out west or move somewhere else to avoid this? There probably will be a few of those, but, so be it. For the most part, I think that this actually will, employers, 95% of the people in Massachusetts currently have insurance, 94% before we started this reform. Most working folks look for insurance from their employer as very much as an essential piece of the compensation package. And most employers find that if they can at all afford it, it's absolutely critical to attract and retain labor to offer insurance. So this is really only bringing the last 4 or 5% in. And, of course, that's a critical difference when you look at a Texas or a California or even the national average state with three times the uninsured level that we have. It's a much bigger challenge to get most of them insured than we face. So we're blessed with, starting from a higher base, and that's not an accident. This is a state that's very reform-minded. After all, we did once before under Governor Dukakis pass universal health insurance. So it's not a foreign concept here. As Ed mentioned, we've got a lot of market reforms. We've got a very tight rating band. So the oldest, sickest individuals cannot pay more than twice what the youngest, healthiest pay for the same policy under our rating rules. It's guaranteed issue. It's guaranteed renewal. So there's a lot to build on already in place.
How John mentioned the idea of Massachusetts starting at a fairly high level, higher than most other states. We got an email from Kansas, also a state with a relatively modest number of uninsured compared to the national average. But this person also asked about the underinsured and how the development of these state plans may uncover, or are they uncovering, large numbers of underinsured. And is there a method through which states could make an estimate about the number of uninsured and how significant this population may be when developing a state health plan? And Karen, let me ask you, how do we think about this? We don't, our main way of counting the uninsured is through census, CPS data. That doesn't differentiate between what type of insurance people have. If a state is starting the process of putting together a plan like that, how do you think of people who are not just uninsured versus insured, but underinsured as well?
Well, it is a hard thing to measure, the underinsured, and there are some very smart people who've tried, and no one's come up with the exact number. Again, I think you need to go back to what is insurance for. This is in case we get sick. And as a sort of rule of thumb way of evaluating whether insurance is good, you should kind of line it up to a scenario where something really serious happens. So how much of your bill would this policy pay for if you found out you had breast cancer, or if you had diabetes, or if you had a heart attack, or if you got hit by a car? And those aren't so difficult to construct, those scenarios. I mean, you can You don't have to be perfect. You can just kind of, you know, ask a doctor, what do you do for somebody who has breast cancer, and make your little shopping list, and then price it out on some fee schedule. It's all going to vary, but, you know, use Medicare's fees as a decent proxy. Yeah, but you know,
no, I mean, some
pick one.
Yeah, no, I know. Okay. I mean, some of them, you know, you can treat with drugs, and some you
right.
don't.
Right. So just pick one, all right? Because but again, kind of back to my premise, you don't know what you're going to need this for. So pick something that's not too mild, okay?
Yeah.
And then hold it up. There are measures out there today about people who are spending more than a certain percentage of their income on out-of-pocket medical costs who have health insurance. And it's really scary. That number is going up. that people are paying, you know, 10-15% of their 30% of their income on their out-of-pocket medical bills because their insurance doesn't cover mental health, and they've got a kid with a really scary eating disorder, because it doesn't cover drugs, and they've got cancer, because it doesn't have an out-of-pocket limit on your cost sharing, and they have diabetes. And they don't have one big bill, but they have a bunch of little bills that just happen day after day after day after day, never stops, and it adds up. I think you also have to look at health insurance. We think of it, we buy health insurance 1 year at a time, which is so funny. I mean, we don't buy toothpaste one squeeze at a time, you know, but we buy health insurance in these little kind of artificial increments. And most things that can happen to you will take longer than a year, all right? A 9-month pregnancy, chances are that's going to land in 2 policy years, right? Just the odds are. So you can't just sort of look at what your out-of-pocket costs will be this year. It's what will your out-of-pocket costs be over the whole episode of care that you need. So I think we could begin to develop those measures. We really don't have them now. Getting back to what does it take to make a market work, that's a very difficult thing to figure out. And if we could get policies to, or high-risk pools or the Medicaid program or whatever, to sort of hold up that metric and say, well, if you had diabetes and it looked like this kind of a case, this would cover 40% of your bills versus 90% of your bills. That would be really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points on that. I'm not sure. I mean, first of all, if you have the right innovation, you'll move in that direction. Anyway, I mean, one of the interesting things, for example, Switzerland has a similar sort of system. I mean, Professor Herslinger at Harvard Business School talks about it a lot, of, you know, universal required individual insurance. In fact, they just voted down the idea of single payer by about 3-1. But they've developed 5-year plans, okay, where it is very comprehensive, covers everything, and, you know, you go in and they actually do a personal workup, and then you have, like, goals that you work with them to meet on your health and staying healthy and getting healthier over the next 5 years. And depending on how you come out at the end, you get large chunks of the premium back, because what they're doing is they're sharing, they're using their expertise, you know, sharing with you to help you control the cost. I mean, I think the other thing that's important to think about this whenever you're talking about subsidizing people is Karen's right, you have to look at that total picture. But you have to do it without the sort of a bias to saying that, well, somehow out of pocket is bad. I mean, yes, it's part of the total picture. The question of whether you pay directly or you pay through insurance is, to me, I'm agnostic on that question. The question is, does it make sense? Okay, I mean, if it makes sense to do it one way, fine. If it makes sense to do it the other way. What I very definitely would like to see is that if, to the extent you're going to subsidize it, then you should be even in doing that. You shouldn't tilt the playing field one way or another.
In other words, you should be neutral in subsidizing premiums versus...
Right.
Versus
in fact, pressure. I wrote tax credit legislation like that years ago in Congress to say that, you know, the size of your, you know, subsidy would be related to the share of your income you had to spend on the total out-of-pocket and insurance. Because we're going to find that it's oftentimes more efficient to buy some of this stuff out of pocket than to go through insurance. But again, you want a system that where that happens for the people for who, I mean, I'll give you a good example of this. You know, nutritional counseling for diabetes in Medicare, in this sort of rule-driven, you know, the patient's off there in the corner kind of world, and it's just the plan, whether it's a government or private, it doesn't matter, the plan versus the provider, it says, well, we'll pay for 12 hours. Well, this is nuts, okay? I mean, if there's somebody who's a diabetic, and I know them, who are motivated to control their diabetes and through diet and not have to have expensive medical care, for heaven's sakes, we ought to you know, subsidize them to have more nutritional counseling. And if there's somebody who's not motivated to do that, then that 12 hours is a total waste, okay? But this is a sort of provider-oriented system where we need, and that's where you need to move to more of a consumer-oriented system. In terms of the numbers, very quickly, a number of states have looked at, because a lot of the data is wrong, and we know that, have looked at doing their own sort of analysis. We know that nationally, it looks like the census data overestimates the number of uninsured and underestimates, for example, the number of Medicaid recipients by about 10 to 20%, and that's been confirmed by another state. So a number of states have looked at doing their own, and I think some have also gotten at some of these other measures of, well, you know, is this really major medical? And then finally, there are clearly some cases where we know that there are people who are getting care but are not, quote, insured. I mean, a number of states I've worked in out west, their big problem is the Indian Health Service. Now, that's not insurance. It's a healthcare delivery system, okay? But and it's, in theory, 100% federally funded. But the reality is those people don't get what they need, so they have to get it elsewhere, and oftentimes the state has to, you know, winds up picking up part of the cost through Medicaid. So, I mean, it's clear that there are these people out there that have, quote, something, but it's clearly not adequate.
Ed, let me ask you, amazingly enough, we're coming to the nearing the end of the hour. You're talking to folks around the country, a lot of different states. Massachusetts, which I know you've written about as well, you know, many people have pointed to that as an example of where left and right can join together. And John Kingsdale talked about, you know, everyone kind of coming together around a consensus. Is that a political model that you see that can work in other states or that you see happening elsewhere?
Absolutely. I tell people this all the time when I work in the states. I said, look, when I go in there, it doesn't matter if you're the governor or one of the governor's appointees or a legislator. It doesn't matter pretty much what state you're in. And it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal conservative. Your world looks like this. You have a state budget that, in most cases, you have to balance. And it's got three things in it: health spending, education spending, and everything else. And the first one is eating the other two. Okay? So the promise of what Massachusetts is doing, both the piece about reforming the insurance market, which any state could go on and start working on without federal assistance, and then the other piece, which is reforming the subsidies, to say we're going to move from subsidizing providers to treat people that we haven't been able to figure out how to cover, to using that money to buy people coverage. Okay, now you do need federal waivers for that. But each of those pieces has a great deal of attraction to lawmakers at the state level, regardless of where they sit or what their party or ideology is, simply because it's saying, look, here are some creative ways to try to do more with what you've got today in terms of resources and programs. Okay, the tools you have. The insurance piece, you regulate insurance. Okay, you don't have to ask the feds for permission. You can change your market. You can create one of these connectors. The money there, in many cases, you have some control, or with the feds, with a waiver, you can do something. Now, each state will be different. I mean, states like Massachusetts, Louisiana, they've got all the money in one place. Okay, you know, some states, I was in Montana, you know, it's not in public money. It's in private cost shifting. But the cost is there. I mean, Maryland, I was in there, they've got an all-payer hospital rate setting system they've had for the 70s. They're very proud of it. Again, it's a state that could do a lot, but their sticking point is that there's a sacred cow, this hospital rate setting commission, sitting on the money. You got to move the cow off the money if you're going to get something done. So each state has these issues, but it's not really partisan. It's interest group, absolutely. Some of it's personal politics. You know, so-and-so wants to run for governor, this, that. But my impression has been Washington State, they had the Democrat chair of the committee and the Republican ranking and the health committee. They each wrote two different bills on the same model, and then now they've compromised them. So yeah, you can do that.
And Karen, you've worked at the federal level. You've spent a lot of time talking to states. I mean, do you sense momentum happening now at the state level?
Oh, absolutely. And I hope when John's done cleaning things up in Massachusetts, maybe he'll run for Congress and come here and tell us how we did it all, if you have any energy left after that. So I do think there's a lot of great creativity going on in states. And I actually live in Maryland, and I was on the board of our high-risk pool for a couple of years and spent some time in Annapolis. There's some fabulous people who are really devoted to making change and willing to put themselves on the line to do that. And that hospital rate setting system is very nifty. Don't say bad things about it.
Well, no, it's just, but that's where the money is. That's where the money is.
Well, you know. But going to the money, so I think it's great that states are kind of waking us up again, are kind of, you know, perennial. It's time to wake up to do something about our healthcare system. At the end of the day, though, I do think we're a nation, and being sick is awful wherever you are, and we all want to be safe when that happens. And the money is in different places. Massachusetts is always going to have more money than Alabama will. They just are. And at some point as a nation, we need to say, this is important and this is the right and the moral thing to do, and make sure that this can happen everywhere. So I think there's also an important role for the federal government, and I hope soon they will step up to that.
And I think they are. I think they are. I mean, I certainly hear this in Congress, and again, on a very bipartisan basis. I mean, it's interesting that President Bush in the State of the Union proposed tackling the tax treatment of health care, which is the single biggest subsidy in health care right now. And it's very perverse because it gives more money to people who earn more and less to people. You know, he proposed tackling that. That's something presidents have shied away from, including this one. He had an opportunity. I mean, he was being pushed on the Tax Reform Commission a couple of years ago to tackle it. He didn't push it. He dropped it. That now he comes out and does it. And, you know, when you look at that and what Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, is proposing, they're different, but they're in the same ballpark. You know, there's stuff you can work with.
I want to, John, and I want to.
I think it's because states are moving that's happening.
We are over our time, and I want to give you a final word. And John, let me just ask you one quick question, and that's, there have been. You talked about some of the recent news coming out of Massachusetts and some of your recent decisions, and one of those was to delay a bit the mandate that people buy insurance meeting minimum requirements, and there's been some concern raised about that, about whether it raises questions about the sustainability. Of the plan.
Glad you asked me about that, because I want to clear that up. Among the myriad of details that the legislature didn't have to and shouldn't have grappled with is the timing of phasing all these things in. And I've got 25 years of experience in health insurance, and I didn't think about this until 2 months ago, which is people sign up mainly through their employer. Their employers have open enrollment, depending on which employer, every month of the year, and then you are in a plan for 12 months. So what we did is we said, as of July 1, 2007, everybody has to have a plan, okay? Mandate is not delayed. It goes into effect in less than 100 days. What we also said was the people who will get punished for not having minimum creditable coverage, is what we call it, are the taxpayers, the employees. There is no mandate on employers. There is no mandate on health plans. There is a mandate and a tax penalty on individuals for not having minimum creditable coverage. So that means that somebody who is offered non-compliant plan on July 1, because his employer found out on June 14th when we finalized the regs that that's what we wanted, and he's already had his open enrollment in May, that worker on July 1 would be the one who gets penalized because his employer didn't meet our standards. So what we said is, starting at the end of 2007, 4 to 5 months after our plan, our regs are finalized, employers should start complying. We hope they will. We can't force them. We hope they will. So that employees, as early as February 1st, 2008, will have to enroll in a minimum credible coverage compliant plan in order, when the last month of their 12-month enrollment, which is January, in that example, January 2009, when that 12th month comes around, they will have chosen a plan back in February of 08 that is MCC compliant, because on January 1, 2009, across the board, no matter where you are in your annual sign-up year, the minimum credible coverage, new, higher, unprecedented standards. Nowhere else in the country are there standards like this. Those standards go into effect the very first day of 2009, and they will catch anybody who didn't make a decision as early as February 1, 2008 to enroll in an MCC compliant plan. So I hope that's really crystal clear. This is not delayed. We are totally on track.
Well, I appreciate you clearing that up, and unfortunately, we do have to stop it there. I want to thank our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Larry Levitt. You've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. We'll see you next time for Elements of State Health Reform, where we'll be discussing individual and employer mandates.